Welcome to the Cool Things Entrepreneurs Do podcast with your host, Tom Singer. In each episode, we explore the interesting lives of business leaders, entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, and others who have a healthy dose of the entrepreneurial spirit. It is time to explore something cool. Now, here is your host, Tom Singer.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Cool Things Entrepreneurs Do. Thank you so much for pulling your chair up to the Cool Kids table. If you've never listened before, my goal as the host of this show is to bring you really insightful interviews with entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, business leaders, people who work inside companies but who have that spark of entrepreneurship, who really are doing things that can help inspire you. On every episode, my hope is that you're going to find a nugget, a theory, a concept, or an idea that's going to help you get out there and do a little bit more, maybe do a little bit better in your own entrepreneurial journey. And we are up to episode number 374 is where I think we are with this one. And we're going back to the archives. We are revisiting with a guest who was here at around episode 100. I think we decided it was episode 104 that Linda Smith first joined us. Now, she has had one of the most impressive careers as sort of a high-end attorney, sort of, you know, in the high-end bet the company stakes litigation world in Los Angeles. And she has, she has kicked butt and taken names in law. And I'll tell you what, she was even written up in a news article as the meanest woman alive. I mean, think about this. She's a litigator. She would make grown men, CEOs of big companies, just quake in their boots. And now, like so many entrepreneurs, she's doing a pivot. She has left the full-time practice of law, and she's written a book, and she's become a speaker. Now, she was at the top of a game, and I used to be the director of two different AmLaw 100, the marketing director for two giant law firms for their Austin and their Dallas offices back several years ago. So I know what the big high-end law firms are all about. She was at the top of her game for an entire career, and now she's starting over. So we're going to talk a lot about how do you reinvent? How do you pivot? How do you reposition yourself and do something where you don't really know what it is, but you dive in with both feet. So Linda Smith, welcome back to Cool Things Entrepreneurs Do.
Thank you. And it's episode 104 from September 2015.
Wow.
So a lot has happened. And before I do anything else, I wanted to congratulate you on your new book, The Paradox of Potential.
Well, that book is still a process. It's not out yet. That is still big work in progress for me. That one may take another year or two.
I was going to say, I haven't read it yet, but I intend to.
No, it's a work in progress.
But I do also want to tell you, and I may get us off track, and if I am, just pull me back. But the idea that people have high potential and don't realize their potential, or as I listened to the interview you did with Dove.
Oh yeah,
Barron.
Yeah, Dove Barron interview.
And he said,
awesome,
living
interview
in the buoyancy of potential.
Yes. Yeah.
But not, you know, but I could have been a contender, but not actually making it. Dovetails perfectly with my message in the book.
Awesome.
Well, I was so jazzed about it. And in addition, there are, I feel like I'm doing a promo for you. Okay. Is that all right?
Awesome.
You talk about how, you know, in a world full of gadgets, in a gadget craze world, people have to establish personal connections and communications that besides just social media and likes and links and shares, that you have to get back to establishing connections with people. That's a huge, huge lesson, and one that is invaluable. And I think as the world becomes more technologically inclined and everyone spends all this time on their devices, you still don't get what you want if you're an entrepreneur, unless you establish a personal identity and a personal relationship, or at least, I don't want to call it the semblance of a personal relationship because that makes it sound like it's fake. But sometimes, even if you're reaching people on a social media site, it's good to reach out to them individually to respond and be in, whether it's a mastermind group or just a group, and participate with other people.
Well, I tell people all the time, like I get calls from people who, and you're going through this now as well, but I get calls from people all the time who want to become speakers. They think it looks, you know, exciting and you know, thrilling to go and speak on these big stages. And my first question to them all the time is, how many speaker friends do you have? And they'll look at me, sometimes we'll be having coffee, but I just met them, and they'll say, well, there's you. And I have to remind them that, yeah, we're not friends. You just took me out for coffee. I'm talking about real friends who you go have a glass of wine with or a meal.
Right.
And lots of times they're like, well, none. And I said, doesn't matter what industry you're going into, you have to be around people who are successful at that. And going back to your past career, big law, giant law firms have really done a both a good and a bad job. But the part they've done a good job in this is they bring in the summer associates who are law students, and then they hire them as lawyers after they graduate high school. And they're putting these young lawyers into the same office around and working with more successful associates and super successful partners. And they do it. There's a path they have to take. It takes 7 to 10 years to get to partnership. And during that time, they spend a lot of time both working and socially and just hanging out at the water cooler with people who are successful. And success leaves clues. So if you want to be successful at something, you've got to be around people who are doing it. And I think this is a thing now that people think, well, I want to start a podcast, so I'll listen to someone's podcast. Well, that's good. But have you taken that person to lunch? Are you hanging out with that person? And I think, you know, I think you've done that as you've jumped in to the speaking world. You know, you went and got involved with the Los Angeles chapter of the National Speakers Association, and you've been active with them for the last year. And I understand you're going to go, by the time this airs, we will already have had the national conference. But I think that you will have been in Dallas for the summer conference for the National Speakers Association, because you clearly realize if you want to be a speaker, you'd better be watching for the success clues that people are leaving. And the only way to do that is to get around them.
Yeah. And the thing is, there are other parts of my message that also dovetail. And I think maybe we'll just get into it. But one of the my message is mainly I'm on a mission to help women and teach women on their quest for success. And that's what the main thrust of the book is about. And it's all about the fact that women have very high emotional intelligence leadership skills, which are exactly the skills. It used to be command and control was the way large organizations or even small ones operated. The boss is the boss. He makes the rules. Everyone else follows them. Your widgets, depending on how big it is, but you're replaceable, and you basically follow orders. And now in the new work environment, even though their multinationals are getting bigger, et cetera, it's really based on human connection and human involvement and the idea of team building and making people feel significant. And leaders now, they've done all these tests, and the CEOs are not as successful as CEOs as they were beforehand because they don't have the people skills. You need a measure of emotional intelligence to stay as a leader, as a CEO of a big company. Anyway, I have a lot to talk about, and I think I'll let you lead me there. Well, but it is a big transformation for me from being. I still am the meanest woman alive, just so you know. But I've gone from absolute top dog, senior partner, senior litigator, bet the company cases, and as you referred to, I've done the largest antitrust case in the history of the world, representing AMD against Intel in the United States, Korea, Japan, the European Union, Texas, New York, and in front of the FTC. I've done cases like the BCCI case for $30 billion. I did the state Exxon Valdez case for $1 billion. We won all of them. We either had them dismissed or we won, or they settled and they gave us a lot of money. It depends on which side I was on, but generally I'm representing the defendant. And so on the AMD case, and this is just sort of, I want to try to demonstrate the contrast. There were about 100 O'Melveny & Myers lawyers working on it, my law firm, across the globe. And we would have conference calls that were insane because you'd have any time of the day, any time in a 24-hour cycle, you could have a conference call because someone was awake somewhere and someone was, it was the middle of the night for someone else. So you'd have Brussels and Milan and San Francisco and Los Angeles and Tokyo and Seoul and DC all on a conference call. And then add to that layer, sometimes our Japanese counsel needed translation, which may, it was just so, so I go from this incredible, and we have 250 contract attorneys working on the case. Intel has 750 because they're the Goliath and we're the David. And I go from that environment to becoming a solo entrepreneur, sitting alone at my computer, writing a book and trying to figure out how to become an author, a speaker, a podcast, not maybe not a podcaster, but a guest on podcasts, and play with social media, which I've not ever been on other than LinkedIn.
So what's the biggest, what is the biggest change from having hundreds of people on your team to just being Linda?
Well, okay. Let me start out by saying it completely sucks. I'm sorry to use that word, but it's just very hard. I'm a very outgoing person and very collegial, and I love bouncing ideas off other people and love working with other people. And it's a little bit too solitary for me. So it's a dramatic change. And it's not, you know, it's not quite as easy to motivate yourself to keep writing every day and to finish everything. And I'm just learning, you know, at my age, which what do we call it? What do we call it? Experienced.
Seasoned, I think is what some
seasoned. People. Yes, that's even better. I love seasoned. Just learning how to network, because which is, as you know, and as you preach, is critically important. And the thing is, while I've been surrounded by people in my firm, co-counsel and adversary counsel, and whatever corporation I'm representing, I become very, I basically become, it's like being married to the CEO or the chairman or the general counsel, and I'm with all the top management people. And so you're always developing networks among the people who are trusting you and relying on you, and you know, et cetera. But I never did a business development pitch in my entire life. I was not the kind of person who went to bar association meetings to hustle business or to make connections. I didn't do any of the things that one should do in order to have a network. And in fact, most of my cases were on a national basis. And so I don't even have like a Los Angeles or Southern California base. National Law Journal made me one of the called me one of the top 50 women litigators in the U.S. But in my space in Southern California, I mean, people know me, but most of my cases are, the AMD v. Intel case was based in Delaware, and AMD was in Austin and also up in San Jose area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've tried cases in San Antonio. I've been all over the United States. I spent a year in Denver on a case. So I never did that groundwork or foundational work of actually establishing relationships, and not just glad handing, because I know that you believe, and I totally agree with you, that it needs to be you need to have a more personal relationship. I think Honoré Corder calls it business dating.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And Honoré, I know Honoré, and she's very good at all that stuff too.
And that you have to have six or seven touches.
Yeah, I tell people it's 7 to 10 interactions with people, not before your friends, but before they even notice you exist. So it takes a while to build this stuff. But you bring up an interesting thing because of your national legal reputation and the size of the firms that you worked with and the types of cases that you were known for. I worked with these types of litigators in my career, and I still work with a lot of law firms and speak at a lot of like partner retreats type events. And the truth is, for a lot of these, you know, hard-edged litigators, at some point, they realize they don't have to do that type of work. It's not local-based. They don't have to go to their chamber of commerce. They don't have to do it. And they almost take pride in the fact that they're gruff. They don't need any more friends. And then their life changes and they hang out their own shingle or they make a change to another thing. And it's like a deer in the headlights. So, you know, you're kind of having that same experience. What are you doing then to be able to do that stuff?
I'm suffering. The thing is, I'm going to take exception to being gruff or arrogant because I just never had to. And it wasn't even, I never had to as a first year, I worked on what was a gigantic case for IBM against Transamerica against IBM up in San Francisco, where I was 17th out of 17. And since that time, that was my first case, I've never not had a case. And what happens is you're an associate and then the client, you know, starts calling you and pretty soon they're your client. And so I've never done it at all. The only way I'm really, really good at establishing strong relationships with clients so that they trust me and they believe in me. And of course, I have to win. That's just a given. The excellence is assumed. But then, okay, so now I'm sort of floundering a bit. Honoré Corder is my coach on this, and she has helped me with introductions, and I've tried to talk to a lot of other people and get introductions. I have written the book, and the other thing I did, this is actually really funny, especially if you only knew me. Let me just depart for 1 second and tell you, there's a skit that Amy Schumer did with her, and it was a skit she did where she and her supposed mother, of course it was a skit, so it wasn't her real mother, were before a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist starts out and says, "Now, I want the two of you to be civil. There's no need to scream, cry, or yell at each other. Please promise me you'll try to be civil." And they both say yes. And she said, "Okay, let's begin." And the mother takes out her computer. And the psychiatrist says, "Turn it on." And the mom is sort of trying to figure out where the power button is. And Amy is freaking out. "Mom, you know where the power button is. Mom, you know, it's over where it says power, right there. So she finally leans over and turns it on. And it goes on like that until they're finally absolutely screaming at each other. Well, that is, my son made me watch the skit because he thought it was hilarious and represented exactly how I am with technology. But anyway, so being technologically challenged, I'd never been on Facebook. I've been on LinkedIn for years and I have 4,000 connections and all that, but I'd never been on social media. I'd never been on Facebook. And so I went on a site that I called the Meanest Woman Alive. So it's just meanestwomanalive.com on Facebook. And I started posting and I was a complete, well, I don't know what we like to call it, doofus. I used word swag, and I would come up with, I'd get the images, and then I'd put something on it, you know, something cool. And then I try to post it, and then I look at it and realize that it only half the picture showed, so I had to delete it, or none of the words were showing up, you know, or half the words were cut off or whatever. Anyway, I have, in 1 year, I have 425,000 followers.
Wow.
Yeah. Because, and you know, so it's like, it's sort of amazing. And I'm doing, you know, I'm doing great on Instagram and Twitter, but my main focus is the Facebook page. But 425,000 is not bad for a newbie.
That is not bad for anybody. That's awesome.
And you know, how you, I also have over 25,000 subscribers, which are, you know, your special peeps who give you their email addresses and get your newsletters, et cetera. So I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, I think you're doing pretty well. So, go ahead.
No, you go.
Really quick, you've talked a couple of times about the release of your new book. So what is the title of the book?
Okay. It's I want to talk a little bit about my message only, but only when you want me to, because it really, so reinventing myself has been writing the book, which was, you know, the thing is I've written legal briefs for 40 years. I've, you know, written legal briefs to the U.S. Supreme Court. I've argued everywhere. So I, you know, that's my life and I'm damn good at it. But, you know, so writing a book is not the same as writing a legal brief. And in fact, I had a fight with my copyright, my proofreader or whatever. I wanted the footnotes to be on the page because I'd done a lot of research and I had studies backing up everything I said and did. And as a lawyer, you always want to show your source material so the judge understands that, or the judges understand, you know, that you're not making this up, you've got a cite for it. And they said, no, if you include them at all, put them at the end, which I ended up doing after looking at Sheryl Sandberg's book and Sally Krawcheck's book and some of the other books like that and realizing that they do put them at the end. And so I had to figure out how to write like in my voice, because people say when they read the book, it's like talking to me. And then I had to start to learn how to network from scratch in a world I know nothing about, which is the podcaster, influencer, writer world. And then I had to start playing with social media, which I also knew nothing about and made some mistakes. Anyway, so it's been a fascinating journey. I wish I didn't have to take it. I want to start at the top. I say that the problem that millennials have is that they want to start out as the CEO because they were raised to think they were snowflakes and special and they don't want to do the grunt work at the bottom. They want to get to the top. Well, I was at the top. I didn't want to start over at the bottom, but I did. Anyway, the book is called Smashing Glass and Kicking Ass.
Oh, I like lessons, that.
Lessons from the Meanest Woman Alive.
That's
and of course, being a lawyer, I have a trademark on Meanest Woman Alive.
Sure, of course. But that's an awesome title. And one of the things that where I think it's going to play really well is there are a lot of law firms who have women initiative meetings. I mean, I think that, you know, you can combine your old world and your new world, because I think that there's, you know, in the legal world, that's a key important topic. Still in big law is how do women, you know, rise through that ceiling. So I think you're onto something for both the legal world, but then the corporate world. There's a lot of events where that's the topic they're looking for. So I bet you're going to get to the top really quick.
Well, I hope you're right. Maybe this will put me at the top really quick. But the one thing I wanted to mention though is that this book is not written for lawyers. It's written, I thought my target audience was going to be women coming out of either grad school or maybe just graduating from college, going into any career, because the lessons that I have to teach and the, you know, I mean, just there's, in addition to my overlay, which is the general thing, which I'll talk about in a minute, there's, you know, speaking truth to power, faking it till you make it, showing true grit, how to deal with interruptions, how to develop confidence, like, you know, many, many of those kinds of lessons. And then I illustrate them with stories from my own career, which are generally hilarious or sort of amazing. But and I understand that people won't necessarily have those experiences, but I'm using them as an illustrative mechanism. And I thought it was because women are entering the workplace and then not making it. And I can go into that forever, but really not much has changed. So what I'm seeing is that today's women are stalled in their quest to advance their careers. And across every level of work, in every industry, women still struggle to earn the same level of pay, to receive equal access to opportunity and promotion, and to do the work they were hired to do without fear of harassment or the discrimination of gender bias. And what happens is, as you go up the ladder of success or whatever you want to, as you go up the career ladder, the funnel narrows until mid-management, there's just a few, and then you get to the top and there's virtually no one. And every meeting I go to as a lawyer, as a senior partner representing major corporations with co-defense counsel, all of whom represent major corporations, or opposition counsel representing the other side in major corporations, I am the only woman there.
Oh, still. Yeah, absolutely. Even in today's age, when the farther you get to the top, the less and less women are there.
Yeah. So anyway, I thought, but we've done some testing on Facebook. And I think the reason this site took off is because it's women's empowerment with a twist. And the twist is that women already have the ability and unique advantages as women that they can use to lead. And they just don't know it, and they're not tapping into it. But anyway, so we tried to figure out by using different buckets to analyze who's looking at the page. And we divided them between women who were 24 to 34 and women who were 35 to 54 or something like that. And we found that while both are very responsive, the older group is more responsive and more into my page than the younger group. And I do blogs and posts and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's because, and my stepdaughter said this to me, I think as a woman, you start out, you get out of school. First of all, you're in school and you graduate in equal numbers generally, like in law school, but and in business school, not maybe in STEM. We can talk about that another time. And then you go into jobs in equal numbers. And you have to be there for a few years when you start realizing that you're not advancing like the men, or that the men have mentors and sponsors and you don't, or that the men are golfing and you're not going, or the men are playing poker and you're not going, or whatever is happening and men are getting the better assignments and men are dominating the meetings, or you know, men are speaking and you're not. And so it takes some time as a woman to start realizing that things aren't right. It's not as obvious as it was when you're the only woman 40 years ago walking into a place. But it's still the same. And I've talked to zillions of women in their very successful women who are doing fine in their early and mid 30s who say, you know, when they go out to dinner with a client, their boss says, make sure you wear a short skirt.
Still, that's still
yes.
being said.
Or,
yikes.
Or their boss has tried to feel them up or ask for sex, or that they're still always a member of the team, but never the lead. Or, I mean, I can go on and on about this, and I have all the stats to show. I mean, let me just give you one stat because this really amazed me. 7% of venture capital goes to women.
That's too low.
And women have something like an $11 or $12 billion, trillion-dollar, I don't know what it is, buying power. 7% of venture capital goes to women, and when they get it, it's 20% less than men will get for their venture capital endeavor. All I'm saying is you started out by asking me about doing this for legal groups, and I'm happy to do that, and I think it's a fertile ground because – after 40 years as a lawyer, we come out of law school, probably 60-40 women. We get hired 50-50 women. And now today, 15% of partners are women.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's
it just astonishes me. But yeah, I guess what I'm saying is this applies to all women. It applies if you work in the management structure at a department store, if they still have those, or whatever else is going on. And the other, it dovetails. I wrote this book before the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement, were, you know, and Weinstein were exposed. But I have one chapter of the book is called Neutralizing and Isolating Assholes. And another,
I like that.
And another chapter of the book is called Dealing with Men Who Think with Their Dicks. And so there are, and believe me, those are just like the shocking titles. There's other ones that are much more.
Well, as the father of two daughters, I think yes. that the mission that you are on as you make this huge pivot in your career in your seasoned years here, I think it's an important mission. And I think you're going to find that it's a tough ladder to climb. I've been on it for a long time in the speaking and authoring world. But I think that you're doing a lot of things right. And I think that you're going to find yourself really having success in it. So as we kind of get to wrapping this up here, what's the one thing you would tell business professionals, maybe women, but business professionals in general, who have to make a pivot for whatever reason? What do you wish you knew 2 years ago before this pivot began that you didn't know that you wish you did?
Oh, can I go back to what I wish I knew the whole time?
Sure.
Okay, I'm sorry to change this, but I think this might be, there's two things I wish I had known. One, that that women excel at emotional intelligence. And researchers identified 12 competencies that are key markers of the emotional intelligence required for leadership. And those are not just soft skills, the warm and fuzzy skills. Those are driving for success and reaching your goals and all that kind of stuff. And women score higher than men in 11 out of those 12 emotional leadership competencies. And so we have the ability to lead. We just, as I said, we just don't know it. And the second thing, which is something that probably applies to everyone, and I've heard men talk about this too, is it's particular to women because women are taught to be good little girls, and boys will be boys, and boys can be obstreperous and break the rules and risk and fail and all that kind of stuff. Girls are supposed to be good, and so women have bought into the myth that competence is the key to success. And as long as you work hard and do a good job, you'll advance. That's totally, completely wrong. Self-confidence beats competence every time. And there are scientific studies that show this over and over again. So men, this applies to you too. I know women are sort of raised to believe in, you know, in being good and being excellence, and excellence will out. But self-confidence beats competence every time.
So it's interesting you say that, because in my work and the study I'm doing with this whole paradox of potential, over 70% of the people I interview say they're not living up to their potential at work. And that's what a lot of this whole thing is about what's holding people back. How do we get them to accomplish more? However, of the almost 30% of the people who say, oh yeah, I'm kicking butt, I am living up to my potential, here's the weird statistic. 90% of the people who say that are men. Now, I don't go down that path to find out why, but I find it very fascinating that the people who say, I'm kicking butt and taking names, are almost all men. And yet, in my own life, when I look at the entrepreneurs and the just people in business who I think, wow, they're crushing it and they're so good, they don't make mistakes. It's often women. So the women aren't standing up saying, yeah, I'm crushing it. And I think that is definitely a cultural issue, is why that answer is coming up that way.
Well, but also here's the deal for men and women. Confidence is a skill, and like any other skill, it can be acquired and cultivated so that it grows. So my step one is my Nike advice: just do it. Act confidently. Acting is a big part of the job. That doesn't mean you need to go through your career pretending, but the first step in jumpstarting your ability to maneuver with assertiveness and poise is to take action, and action breeds confidence. And once you see you can do something, it bolsters your ability to take another action or face another risk. And so I have examples of public speaking and how you speak to a little small audience and your world doesn't end and they don't they don't throw Rotten Tomatoes at you. And so maybe you'll do it again. So taking action and risking and doing are the ways. But there's one other thing that I wanted to mention because you alluded to it. And that is, I have this whole thing about using your femininity, but not your sex, but your femininity. But I think we need to do that another time because I think we're running out of time. But
yeah,
I wanted to mention one other thing, and that is research has found that the one personal quality shared by the most prominent leaders in every field, and this is men or women, is grit. And I don't know if you agree with this. I know you're looking at this whole thing, but
I love the word grit.
It's a combination of mental toughness, courage, hard work, and sometimes sheer stubbornness to reach your goal. And I really think that grit has a lot to do with it because there are people of equal intelligence and equal talent who don't make it.
Yep.
And the winners are the people who have grit. Well, grit and confidence.
And I ask a lot of the people who I interview, what do you think it is that helps people get across that gap from potential to results? And they don't use the word grit necessarily, but the definition you use for it, that's what they say. You've got to just keep going. You just got to pull yourself back up by your bootstraps. And I think that's a great place to sort of wrap up this interview, because I think that's what you've probably known through your whole career to have achieved everything you achieved in sort of the tough world of big law. However,
yes.
I think you're finding it as you're rebranding yourself and pivoting that you've got to double down and have twice the grit. Is that right?
Yes. Twice the grit and also learn how to fail and get up again, or learn that you're not the best at something and accept that, but decide you're going to be the best.
Well,
because you're going to work hard and you're stubborn and you know you're just going to bend the world to your will.
Well, Linda, thank you for coming back and being a repeat guest here on Cool Things Entrepreneurs Do. You and I will meet in person before this actually has the chance to air, but I think that that's going to be great. I look forward to having a glass of wine with you at the National Speakers Association, and I'm sure our paths will continue to cross. We'll have you back on the show in another year and a half or 2 years, and we'll see where the meanest woman alive, what she's up to at that time. So if somebody has to get in touch with you, they're like, I must know more about Linda Smith. How do they find you?
Okay. Well, the book is on Amazon in paperback, Kindle, and audio. It's got a great Audible presenter. And it's called Smashing Glass and Kicking Ass, Lessons from the Meanest Woman Alive. My website, shockingly, is called Lessons from the Meanest Woman Alive. And my Facebook is meanestwomanalive.com.
So you should be pretty easy to find if you just search Meanest Woman Alive.
And yeah, and the only and the same. I think on Twitter it's Meanest Woman, and on Instagram it's Meanest Woman or something like that. But sure. On LinkedIn, I'm still just Linda Smith.
Well, awesome. Well, I think that you've inspired a lot of people, and I think that a lot of people are going to want to rush out and get your book. Like I said, I'm looking forward to meeting you in person soon here at the National Speakers Association. And thank you again for being a guest on the show. And I say it every time. Thank you to the audience, because if it wasn't for the audience, we wouldn't have a show.
God bless you, audience. And Tom, thank you.
Oh, thank you. We're going to be back soon with an interview with somebody just as cool as Linda Smith. I know you're thinking, Tom, how is that possible? How will you ever find anybody as cool as the meanest woman
alive?
That's
what I'm thinking.
Yeah, we'll do it. We do it every week. But in the meantime, I'm going to challenge all of you. Go out there and have a great day.
Thank you for being part of the Cool Things Entrepreneurs Do podcast. Without your participation and listening to these conversations, there is no show. Connect with Tom at tomsinger.com and follow him on Twitter at Tom Singer. This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.